Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy-eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific start to your weekend. I'm joined this week by critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film God Guide and Cinegods.com and Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian, host of the Canon podcast, as well as the brand new podcast Unspooled. We start this week with Upgrade, a horror film from the creator of the Saw and Insidious franchises. Lee Whannell is the writer-director of the film that stars Logan Marshall Green and Harrison Gilbertson. Amy, what do you think of Upgrade?
Upgrade is definitely worth a watch. It is an upgrade, I guess you could say, from the Saw franchise, which I never had the stomach for. It's very different. It's very different. It stars Logan Marshall Green, who people might know best as the guy who looks like Tom Hardy but is not Tom Hardy, as a man living in this futuristic world, slightly futuristic from where we are now, where there's a Peter Thiel kind of character, a young, insanely rich computer guy who's been creating this implant called STEM. And it's an intelligent device, a chip, like an Alexa almost, that would go into somebody's body and be able to like operate their nervous system so a paralyzed person can walk. And very early on, Logan Marshall Green becomes paralyzed, gets this STEM implant. And the film, from that point on, gets truly incredible. It starts off very glum, that kind of, I'm a man and I'm sad and I'm sighing and I live in gray stone bunkers and the world is really depressing. But once he gets this STEM implant, you realize that Lee Whannell has really thought of everything that could happen to you if you had a brilliant Alexa making your arms and legs move for you. And the film just gets fantastic. It has this kind of look to it where it looks expensive and cheap at the same time. You can tell they didn't make this movie for giant studio money, but they try to make it look giant at the same time. It has a really slick, interesting and creative kind of production design to it that I think a lot of people are just going to be wowed by. It's astonishing what they really pulled off here in building
this
world.
Is this a little like Ex Machina, which didn't have a huge budget but looked impressive nonetheless?
Yeah, it's definitely in the key of that. It also reminded me a lot of Crank. If people have seen Crank, the fantastic Jason Statham movie, it builds to that kind of a tone, and the action scenes in an Upgrade just are standouts. When they happen, when the very first one happens, I started giggling because I had no idea this is where the movie was going to go, and it was the best surprise.
You really love this film. It sounds like a lot of fun.
I guess I did. I mean, the scientist character is ridiculous. You know, he's like very vampy. He makes no sense at all. He looks like he's about 13. It's like if Macaulay Culkin from Home Alone suddenly was very powerful. Like, no, this is not actually
Well, he did fight happening. Off those burglars.
Fair point. Okay, then let's make that movie.
It sounds really fun. Upgrade is the horror film. Logan Marshall Green stars Lee Whannell, the writer-director. It's rated R in wide release. Adrift, based on the true story of a young couple who set sail. Their celebratory trip turns disastrous. Shailene Woodley and Sam Claflin star. Baltazar Kormákur is the director of the film, and it's written by Aaron Kandel, Jordan Kandel, and David Branson Smith. Tim, what'd you think of Adrift?
Ah, yes. Actually, I rather like the film. People who listen to the show will know that I have issues with that phrase, based on, which is almost a useless phrase in the context of cinema. Keep that in mind when you're watching this movie, but it is a harrowing story about this young couple at sea. They're taking a ship. He's English. She's an American young woman, and 22 years old. He's a little bit older. And they're taking this yacht back to San Diego. Horrible storm happens. This all actually happened in 1983.
It was a full-on hurricane.
Oh, full-on hurricane. And they tried to outrun it and didn't quite make it. And most of the story is about what she has to do to make sure that they survive. 41 days at sea. And she has to learn how to navigate with a sextant and to track the currents and do all of these things. And it really is just a deep story. Now, it's told not in my favorite way of storytelling. It's told in flashbacks. And whenever you see a movie that's told in flashbacks, you can almost count on somebody's cheating. And there's a little cheat that goes on in this movie, but it's such a beautiful love story. And for me, it all hangs on Shailene Woodley. She's just absolutely magnificent. I have just never not adored her in a movie.
Well, I was going to say, in a movie like this, it seems like when you only got two characters in a small space, that their chemistry, their acting chops are going to, you know, for lack of a better term, sink or make the film rise.
Yeah, their chemistry really does sell this. They have so much in common as a couple. You really get that these are two people who dropped off the grid, meet in Tahiti. She's a vegetarian. He is just a kind of guy who floats around the globe. You sense their real bond and that these two people are so lucky they found each other. And you're invested in their romance really heavily, really heavily. And Shane Woodley just has the right aura, I suppose, to play this part. She's incredibly strong. She's very athletic. When they go cliff diving in this movie, she's actually cliff diving. And cliff diving is just a thing that she does. You know, when she was a teenager, she's in Hawaii making The Descendants. Now she's here making this film. It just all fits together. Yeah, and the storms themselves, when they happen, are absolutely terrifying. You know, it wakes up mid-storm aftermath where their ship is filled with water. She's bloody. She's screaming. She's disoriented. And you really feel her concussion. You can feel the trauma that she's undergone. And when the story kind of builds back to the moment of the actual hurricane, I was losing it. I mean, I'm terrified of hurricanes anyways. I guess everybody is who's not. But
particularly if you're on a boat in the middle of the Pacific, then they're really scary. But the love story, right? I mean, it's the love story. And if you go just for that, you will come away deeply satisfied with this movie.
All right. Sounds like another strong entry this week, Adrift in wide release. It's rated PG-13, starring Shailene Woodley and Sam Claflin. Rodin is an account of the famous French sculptor's romance with Camille Claudel, the film written and directed by Jacques Douillon. Tim, what do you think of Rodin?
This is actually my favorite film of the week, aside from being a very powerful film about Rodin and Camille Claudel and their passionate love affair. It's a beautiful film. Done in a very interesting way. It's broken up into these sequences that move in chronological order, and most of them are connected to whatever sculpture he was working on at the time, and all of which were extremely controversial and mostly not liked at the time. And he was really being attacked by society and government and all kinds of people who just did not like these things. That his Balzac was hated, but he would not yield. He would not yield. One of the reasons he would not yield is because that 19-year-old girl was right behind him saying, "Don't yield. Don't yield." And it was his backbone. Now, she met him when she was 19, which is about when this movie starts. He's about 25 years her senior. And this movie tells that story. He had a longtime companion named Rose, who was not his wife, but they did have a child together. And it really is all about his perspective on their relationship. I suggest that you watch this movie on a double bill with Camille Claudel, 1988, Isabelle Adjani,
yeah,
and Gerard Depardieu.
Yeah, I remember that film well.
Yeah, which is from her point of view. From her point of view, he was the crazy one, which is an interesting kind of thing. If you want to, throw in a third movie. Camille Claudel, 1915, which stars Juliette Binoche, came out about 4 or 5 years ago, 2013, I think. And it's about her period in that asylum. Her brother actually put her in the asylum, Paul Claudel, the mystic poet and scientist. And if you watch all three of these movies together, you'll get a really good sense of what's going on. This particular movie, beautiful all by itself. The sculptures, you know what's funny? You never see a finished sculpture in this movie.
He's always in process.
They're all in process and they're in clay. And the movie is as much about his process as it is their love affair. But his process is not possible without their love affair.
And it does justice, you feel. You know, so often movies kind of give short shrift to the actual artistic process, and it's all about the personalities, bigger than life personality of the artist. This does show him really working.
And this is one of the things that I love. Vincent Lindon, who's wonderful with that beard and all that kind of stuff. But long sequences of this movie, him doing nothing but working. Positioning his models, light coming down from the ceiling. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. I like it quite a lot.
Rodin is the film, a French biographical drama written and directed by Jacques Douillon. It's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. American Animals, the story of an audacious heist that's written and directed by Bart Layton, making his feature directorial debut. Amy.
Well, at the risk of making Tim throw his pen at me, American Animals is based on a true story.
Can you retaliate?
It's based on a true story about an actual heist that took place at Transylvania University in 2003, starring four college kids who decided that they were going to steal the original Audubon's Birds of America, that original giant book of paintings from their library, which was worth about $12 million.
This is the original Audubon book with all the hand, wow.
With the hand-painted birds.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful work of art.
Literally priceless.
Literally priceless. And these are not kids who know fences. So they have to figure out how to find a fence. They have to figure out everything.
Is this based on a true story?
It is based on a true story.
Talk about audacious theft.
I know. And the way that it's structured is that you have interviews with the real people. You know, it feels almost like a fake docudrama until I was like, no, I Googled everybody that is the actual people who did try to steal.
It's kind of I, Tonya in that way, right?
It is, because it's about memory. You have these four people recounting what happened. You have their parents talking about it, too. And then as the actors live it out, and it's an amazing cast. Evan Peters, who's great. Barry Keoghan, who's fantastic. The film shifts underneath you. They'll say that somebody's wearing a purple scarf. No, it was blue. And the scarf will change. The movie will rewind. Faces will change. Locations will change. And it's wrestling with the idea that nobody can completely agree how this happens. And that part of the film is fantastic. Then it becomes a crime caper, which gets a little bit more boring. It's not messing with it as much. It's more just a thriller.
Because it happens the way it happened. It happened the way it happened. And I guess they got to do that.
And I guess the cops were able to write it all down for them. So there is a definitive record.
I have one problem with this film. If this film was just a made-up film, you know, like Ocean's 8 or Ocean's blah, 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 that fine. And wouldn't bug me at all. But this is a thing that happened. And the people who did this thing are in this movie. And the thing that this movie seems to miss mostly to me is that these four young, white, privileged, rich young men were complete sociopaths.
Do you think so? Oh, I don't think so at all.
Normal, no. No, this, now, I'll tell you why. Because they did that violent thing. And and that violent thing, that now we're in
you
a different.
You feel that revealed who they were.
Yeah, and I'll tell you another thing. If you read, there are a few things that the actual people say in the movie, because they're being interviewed. They're sitting there and they're talking back and forth. And they have this sort of attitude. They have this sort of particularly Spencer, I think is his name. And Spencer talked about, you know, being an artist and what it takes to be an artist and how he has to, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, you and everybody who ever wanted to be an artist, what makes you special?
Okay, wait.
All of these guys. I'm sorry, Amy, go on.
You can get an army of pens to throw me because I couldn't disagree with you more. I mean, the violent act that happens here, this film becomes about the guilt they all feel. They're all traumatized by the violence that happens. I don't think these kids are sociopaths in the slightest. I think it's about how the four of them kind of willed each other to do something none of them would have done alone. And it gets into the idea that they're all influenced by other movies. They're quoting The Matrix at each other. They give each other nicknames from Reservoir Dogs, which really happened. Even though one of the guys was like, why do we need nicknames? We all know each other.
Yeah.
That doesn't even make sense.
All of that did happen. But to me, that in and of itself is slightly sociopathic.
It's not sociopathic. It's just being, I assume it's just
no,
a kid.
I posed to myself the question. Is there any circumstance at all, ever, in which I would have done any of these things at their age? They're 22, 23 when this happened. It all happened. They're not even 30 now, these young men. And the reason why I think it's true is because when you see them talking there, the actual guys again, they're very glib about it all, particularly the one guy. What's his name with the hair? And he's in film school. And what's happening to all these guys who did this thing? They did go to prison, by the way. They spent 7 years in prison. So they were punished for their crime. But all of their lives get to start again. They're all going to make money from this movie. And I find it obnoxious that in the greater world, we look at this terrible crime that these people committed and what they did to that old lady. And we go, oh, isn't that a cute movie? Well, I guess it is a cute movie. But you know what? These guys suck and I don't like them.
Well, I feel like you saw a completely different movie than me. But I am interested in the fact that you are going to go on air right now and say you would never steal a $12 million book. You're just going to commit to that? I mean, your life could take turns.
I'm going to go ahead and say no. And by the way, also the Darwin book. They stole the Darwin book, too.
The original origin of the species, where species is misspelled.
Whoa. Is this a docudrama? So you've got the actual guys being interviewed and then actors
portraying them. And every now and again, we cut. I tell you, every now and then. Now, if those guys weren't in the movie, or again, if it were really just a made-up movie, I wouldn't feel this way. But I'm looking at those guys, and I don't see any regret or remorse or anything.
I see nothing but okay, okay.
American Animals, the movie we're talking about, written and directed by Bart Layton. By the way, John Horn of The Frame interviewed Bart Layton earlier this year as the film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. You can hear John's interview with Bart Layton where they go into detail on the real crime. That's at kpcc.org/theframe. Coming up, we'll hear about the comedy Action Point, starring Johnny Knoxville, yet another one of those Jackass-styled films, and Discreet from writer-director Travis Matthews. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, or listening to the podcast, your favorite source for podcasts. Much more to come in just 1 minute.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Such a pleasure to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Amy Nicholson and Tim Cogshell. And I hope you will join us Saturday night. If you're listening to the Saturday noon broadcast, that means tonight. If you're listening to us live Friday, it means tomorrow night at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, 7 o'clock. We're going to show The Graduate, 50th anniversary of the classic comedy. And I'll be joined on stage by our Film Week critic, Peter Rayner, by the writer, actor Buck Henry, who's going to be joining us, Lawrence Terman, the producer of the film, who continues to run the producer's program at USC, also Beverly Gray, author of a recently published book on the cultural significance of The Graduate. Tickets are available kpcc.org/in-person. I just got an update on the ticket sales. They are going very fast. There's a good chance we'll sell out, so make sure that you get your seats right now. It's going to be a great evening. We'll laugh together watching the film on the big screen. I've never even seen The Graduate on a big screen, so that's going to be fun. And then you're going to hear from two people who were there with the making of the film and principals with its creation. So please join us Saturday night, 7 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel. Next up for Tim and Amy, we've got a review of Action Point, a comedy that stars Johnny Knoxville. I guess it's its own genre of Jackass-style films. It's directed by Tim Kirkby. Amy?
Well, Larry, as a proof of my love for you, I went to go see Action Point last night at 12:05 in the morning because it did not screen for critics.
But not like that.
I hope you didn't hurt yourself. All right.
Only my soul. Action Point is a slight detour for the Jackass crew. It's their first movie with vaguely a narrative plot about it. It's based on the true life theme park, Action Park, in New Jersey, which was famous for being called Traction Park, for having the most dangerous rides in the world. 6 people ultimately died.
I remember this place, yeah.
Yeah, they do a riff of one of the commercials for Action Park in here, in Action Point, which is their version of what they call it now. And Johnny Knoxville, of course, runs it, and he's doing a bit of his bad grandpa thing, where the framing of the story is that he's now an old man telling his granddaughter about the awesome days in the 70s where he was running this theme park. And it's kind of the story that's giving that's celebrating the back in the day when young kids just liked to get hurt. It's kind of a raspberry to the nanny state and to lawyers and to safety in
general. Regulations made all that stuff safer.
Exactly. It's sort of like, we shouldn't be safe. and it's very just dug into that. 6 people do not die, even fictionally, in this film. But Johnny Knoxville gets very hurt. It's interesting that in a movie where he actually has dialogue, the stunts that he does have even less of a narrative setup than any of the Jackass movies. You know, the Jackass movies are kind of structured like, we're going to do this crazy thing. Let's talk about it. I'm really scared. Okay, let's do it. And then everybody gets hurt. So there's this buildup. Here in Action Point, it's just Johnny Knoxville getting, like, hit by a fire hose and catapulted into a barn. And nothing actually has any setup. He falls down all the time. He falls down about every 30 seconds. And you just start to really feel bad. He's just getting hurt for no reason throughout this whole movie. He spent 3 years making it. He got 4 concussions. And I like Johnny Knoxville. I honestly do. I think there's this world where he could have been our great physical comedian of this era, but now he's just taking these punishing hits for a film that is not very good.
Well, given your affection for him, that must have been hard to see him hurt himself that way.
It is. There's an early fall, and it's just a fall. I think he gets hit by a 2x4, and he does a flip and lands on his hips, and it takes him a while to get up. You see him, he's in his late 40s now. His knees just don't seem to be working as well. It's brutal. You want him to be doing something softer to himself. I think he's earned it. I think he's definitely earned it. The Jackass movies are fantastic. This is not worth the hurt he took.
So for fans of Jackass, the hardcore audience for this, is it going to be what they expect?
I don't think so, because Jackass movies had a real visual wit, honestly. Jackass 3, their 3D movie, was truly beautiful.
That's just a crazy sentence.
I mean, if anybody saw Jackass 3D, you know that
Jackass
they did some
3,
gorgeous
the legacy.
Stuff. They were doing things in Jackass 3D where he was...
returns.
Okay, I see that y'all are fans. That's fine. But he was painting himself to look like a rainbow and then standing in front of a rainbow wall and seeing if a bull could see him and if a bull would run right into him. I mean, it was really visually inventive. Here, the best scene is when somebody puts a squirrel in their pants and you're like, oh, that's a real squirrel. Oh my God, okay.
Mm. The film is Action Point, starring Johnny Knoxville. Tim Kirkby is the director. I wonder what the writers do. John Altshuler and Dave Krinsky wrote it. It's rated R in wide release. The drama Discreet stars Johnny Mars and Atsuko Okatsuko. Travis Matthews is the writer-director. Tim?
Strange little revenge movie. It's about a man. Who was sexually abused as a child. And here he is as an adult, and plainly he has not been dealing with this well. And he goes to engage the man who sexually abused him. This man now is very, very much older and probably suffering from what seems like Alzheimer's, perhaps. Doesn't seem to be there, has a twitch, all of that kind of stuff. This, of course, means that he does not remember or recognize or anything that man, let alone the boy. And this of course, upsets this man because he wants that person to recognize him so that he can exact his revenge. And it's difficult to empathize with the original victim. And you find yourself empathizing more with the original perpetrator. And then the original victim involves another young boy. And what he wants to do is get the original perpetrator to see this young boy and perhaps make a connection between him. There's a little circle there, right? And it all sort of goes into a very dark place. Now, there's this weird through line in this movie that involves that Japanese actress whose name you mentioned and a YouTube show that she does that this man listens to. That is just a complete aside to sort of derails the movie a bit. It's an interesting sort of thing that they're doing, but it derails the movie. And if they had left that out and we had just stayed in this little enclosed thing, I think I could have understood how this could really churn up emotions in a person when they want to get revenge on a person, but it really isn't possible because that person just don't recognize you.
Discreet is the drama. It's at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. It's unrated. The comedy Social Animals stars Josh Radnor, Noelle Wells, and Aya Cash. Teresa Bennett makes her directorial debut and also wrote the screenplay. Amy?
Yeah, Social Animals, not to be confused with American Animals this week. It's
also
a week of
week,
animals.
Yeah.
This is a movie that's a sex comedy about a group of young, attractive Austin people who are reconfiguring their relationships and what they want with each other. There's the single girl who hates love and just sleeps around and has a bikini waxing business. There's a married couple who's really kind of on the outs with their third kid. The wife just wants to redecorate the house all the time. She's played by Aya Cash of You're the Worst, who I think is a really fantastic young comedic actress. And she has a decent role here. And then there's the engaged couple where the girl is engaged to a Republican who makes her sleep with him wearing a George W. Bush mask. So it starts off pretty wacky and broad, a little bit clumsy. And then halfway through, the movie shifts around and it becomes very emotional about like how all of them pursuing their different conflicting desires screw more with the marriage, affect the friendships. There's a fair amount of tears that you're not expecting in this movie when it first starts. I didn't like this movie a lot, but I'm interested in it. You know, I'm interested in Teresa Bennett as a director and as a new voice, because I think she has a good eye for modern stories. I thought this film definitely feels like a first film, and it feels like her giving a showcase for a lot of performers I like a lot. It doesn't add up to as much as I wish it did, but it's interesting.
Social Animals at the AMC Orange and the Galaxy Mission Grove Luxury in Riverside. Teresa Bennett, the writer-director, rated R. A Kid Like Jake. Drama stars Claire Danes and Jim Parsons. Silas Howard is the director. Daniel Pearl, the screenwriter who adapted it from his play A Kid Like Jake. Tim.
Yeah, Silas Howard does a lot of work on Transparent. Which sort of makes sense in the context of this film. So A Kid Like Jake. Jake, the child of Jim Parsons and Claire Danes in the film. Little bitty boy. I'd say he's probably six or something like that.
Four,
something like that. And plainly has a sort of gender dysphoric thing going on. Likes princesses and likes to wear princess dresses. And it's, you know, fairly feminine in that way. They have to pick a school for him to go to. Lots of choices. The public school they don't want. Private school, one run by Octavia Spencer. And she's perfectly happy to have him come there and to help him get into the school. But she is leaning toward them sort of recognizing the nature of their son. You know, we can see your son here, and there's a certain nature to your son, and you ought to recognize that. Claire Danes don't want to do that so much. She's like, no, just leave him alone. Let's not talk about it. Let's not push him this way. Let's not push him that way. Jim Parsons, interestingly, can sort of see his son and see, you know, that there's a direction in which this kid is going, and maybe we ought to not push him in that direction, but not pretend like we can't see it. And all of these adults making these sort of decisions, trying to make these decisions about how to place their son in the academic world. Okay. All of this, I suppose, is something that happens with people. Now, I don't have any children at all. I've taught a lot of children, including gay children. And it seems to me that in this day and age, this should be easier now. I think this should be easier now.
You think the movie is making too much out of
the conflict? I think the movie is making this harder than it ought to be now. And the movie has a really specific thing that it's getting at, and it's a true thing, and I'm sure Amy will speak to it. But I don't know. I'm looking at this kid, and I'm thinking about kids that I had in my classes when I was a guy. And I'm like, that kid's gay. And that's cool. And we're good. And we're going to roll because I can see that that kid is gay. And why not just let that kid be gay? He's plainly gay. And
it's about checking the box for him when he's 4 years old. Yeah. And is he ready to have that box checked when he doesn't even have the language for it yet?
And he doesn't. But it seems to me that these adults do, unless you're pretending like they don't or acting like they don't, because you know what? Kid's gay. What's wrong? What's the problem? We're making a problem where one doesn't exist in my mind.
Well,
but I don't have any kids.
I mean, with the setup here, though, is that they're trying to get their kid into a competitive New York private school. And those are really difficult. And their kid is just average in a lot of ways. He's not exceptionally smart. He's not exceptionally well-behaved. He's nice, but he's not the most charming kid. And checking this box saying they believe he's transgender is the best way they can make an argument for him to be exceptional in any way. But do you check that box for a four-year-old who might just be playing around? And my issue with the film is none of the adults here will say exactly what they mean. They're all very, 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 very polite in talking around it. And then halfway through, it explodes. And Claire Danes says some things about her own gender politics that are kind of like refreshingly mean in this film. But on the whole, it's a little bit tiptoeing.
A Kid Like Jake at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A., and it's unrated. If you're a fan of animation, we've got a very special program at the Aero Theater in Santa Monica, a retrospective, the work of legendary Czech animator and puppet master Yuri Trinka this weekend. KPCC animation critic Charles Solomon weighs in.
This is the week's must-see for animation fans, Larry. Yuri Trinka is one of the giants of stop-motion animation, and one of its poets, really. His puppets are so finely sculpted that when the light shifts on them, they appear to change expressions the way no masks do in Japanese theater. And his films deserve much more attention than they've received in the United States. My favorite, which screens on Saturday, is his version of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is less a retelling of the play and more like a ballet based on it. We're used to seeing animated characters look at each other and fall in love. We're not used to them expressing a sexual tension, which is what he really creates between Oberon and Titania, who are very powerful nature spirits. So these are really exceptional films, and worth the trip to the Arrow to see. I recommend them strongly.
All right, Charles, thanks so much. Again, that's at the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica, the series of the legendary Czech animator and puppet master, Jiří Trnka. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We've got information on that series, by the way, on our Film Week page at kpcc.org. Coming up, are we facing Star Wars fatigue? We'll find out.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Any eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Any eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, with our critics Amy Nicholson and Tim Cogshell. Well, last week we heard our critics' review of Solo, a Star Wars story. Kind of middling review and middling box office return. The film was anticipated to bring in around $155 million domestically. It pulled in just over $100 million domestically. The question is, was it the film itself, Solo, a Star Wars story, that proved to have weaker word of mouth, not as appealing for people to come back and see the film a second time? Or is it indicative that Disney is releasing too many Star Wars films and that audience fatigue is playing a role? With us are Film Week critics to talk about the issue, as well as Scott Mendelson, contributor to Forbes, where he covers the film industry. He takes issue with the notion that it is Star Wars fatigue overall to blame. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Scott, why do you think this isn't about the series, it's just about this film?
Well, I think at the end of the day, without completely discounting the idea that certain audience members said, another Star Wars film, it's only been 5 months, I think if your average audience member saw the previews to Solo and read the reviews and saw the posters and all the generic advertising and saw, oh, that movie is something that I would like to see in theaters relatively quickly, they would not have cared that it was the second Star Wars film in 5 months. In the same way that if the new Marvel film looks like something they want to see, they'll go see it. Or if the next Conjuring picture, you know, comes out X number of months after Annabelle 2, they'll go to see that too. At the end of the day, if the movie looks good enough to see in theaters, they will go. If it doesn't, they won't.
All right. Amy, what do you think? Do you think that given the large number of Star Wars films, people are starting to burn out?
I mean, speaking for myself, I am. I think what a secondary problem is here is that while the main timeline of Star Wars films, you know, the Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi, is the ones that are continuing to progress forward with Rey and Finn and the new characters, those films can go in new directions. These side films, the Rogue Ones, the Solos, they're all prequels. They're all taking place in the past before anything we saw happened with the characters we know, which means they can't take any risks. We know how this film's going to end. We know Solo's going to be fine. We know that these characters who seem like his friends aren't going to be around later because they don't fit in the main timeline that we've had since 1977. To me, they feel really claustrophobic and small-minded. I'm not that interested.
Well, and the other thing is, Tim, you've got to cast these younger actors who are playing characters that we know in these prequel films. And, you know, at some point, the audience not going to buy that.
It's an interesting thing. We over at CineGods, Wade and I, the team, did a tomato slam about all of this. And one of the things I said in my piece is, look, if Donald Glover gives me a decent Billy Dee Williams, I'm okay. And if Alden knocks off dead Harrison Ford, I'll also be okay. Not really. Neither one of
you
them
didn't
really
think
achieved that. No, you know, and maybe that's connected to me. You know, that original film, Larry, that's our film.
Yeah.
That film was made for us when we were teenagers. So to me, all of this ultimately has to please us. I mean, I know that they have this young audience that they want to please, but if they don't please me, you've blown it. And that's all there sort of is to it. I will say this. I think two things can be true at once. I you know, perhaps there is a fatigue with respect to the, and Also, I think it's possible that this just wasn't a very good movie. The reshoots drove the budget up, thus creating a disparity in those numbers.
This was when the new director,
Ron Howard took over. So, you know, added $50 million to the budget. If this film cost what it was originally supposed to cost and still made $103 million, well, then that's not such a crazy flop anymore. So, you know, we're very particular in the way that we decide what is and isn't a flop. This was not a particularly satisfying film to me. But I did like that Rogue One movie, so maybe I'm not fatigued.
All right. I'd love to hear from listeners. If you're listening live on Friday, if you're Saturday listening to the program at noon, you can post on our Film Week page. But if you're listening live Friday in the 11 o'clock hour, let's take your call. If you're a Star Wars fan, do you feel as though Solo, a Star Wars story, and its comparatively poor performance was about that film individually or about a larger issue of Star Wars fatigue with so many films that have come out in recent years? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, staff writer for The Atlantic, where he covers culture, David Sims. David, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've written about this, and you think this is part of a larger concern for the franchise. How so?
I think it's not just a matter of everything you guys have been talking about, but just the fact that this brand will get hurt by a perceived failure like Solo, even if it does end up making hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, general disinterest in this movie might be because the reviews were a little poor or because the movie came out a little too quickly, but that's going to hurt any future attempt to lay out a little more original storytelling. You know, they have trilogies planned that are outside of the main storyline, and that's going to be ill-served by Star Wars feeling a little less special.
All right. Again, I'd love to hear from our Star Wars fan listeners, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. If you are listening live on Friday, Joaquin in South L.A. writes on our Film Week page, we now have enough data to conclude Star Wars is dying. Two data points for the main saga, episodes 7 and 8, two data points from the Star Wars universe, Rogue One and Solo. Both experienced a 40% drop from first to second, parallel downward slopes. You want to respond to that, Scott Mendelson of Forbes?
Absolutely. For the record, The Empire Strikes Back was actually the lowest grossing of the original Star Wars films. And Attack of the Clones was the lowest grossing of the second batch of Star Wars trilogies. In both cases, the second film earned over under 35% less domestic and worldwide than the first film in each respective trilogy. So it's not that much of a surprise that The Last Jedi would decrease as much as it did from The Force Awakens. There are some other variables there. Jumanji and Greatest Showman were surprisingly strong competition that Christmas. China doesn't care about Star Wars at all, which we've learned bit by bit over the last four new Star Wars films. So that really hurt the overseas comparison between Force Awakens and Last Jedi. And I think, and this is going back to something that everybody else has said, the idea of Solo is not particularly exciting, even for people that are excited about Star Wars. So we're throwing out all these reasons why Solo didn't do terribly well, and they all come back to specific variables about the movie Solo. Not the Star Wars brand necessarily, not necessarily what is or isn't coming in episode 9, but Solo performed relatively poorly because it didn't seem to be that exciting of a picture, and reviews, while mixed positive, bore that out. And in a world where, quite frankly, not as many people go to the movies anymore just to go to the movies, unless there's something specific that they want to see, if Solo felt like not that much of a priority, they might wait for Netflix. They might wait for VOD. You know, they might show their kids Return of the Jedi instead, which they have in a gorgeous new Blu-ray. You know, but Solo was not an event film, even for Star Wars. And the fact that it was a Star Wars film couldn't help that.
All right. Ben, where are you calling from? I'm sorry, I don't have your location information.
Hi, I'm just in Central LA around the Topeka Robertson area.
Topeka Robertson. Okay, great. So what's your analysis of the Star Wars franchise?
Rather than just saying the, you guys, I think, are saying that the fatigue is happening because of the numbers of films. And I would just point out that between 7 and Rogue One, and then between Rogue One and 8 was a year between each one. Between 8 and Solo was 6 months. And after 7 and Rogue One, they were generally well received. 8 had a lot of controversy about it and left a lot of a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth. So then to come out with something that was generally underwhelming, I think, is really more what we're looking at with the fatigue. Have we had another 6 months?
Yeah.
Kind of like digest Last Jedi, I think we might be looking at it.
So a timing issue. Ben, that's a very interesting analysis. We'll hear what Tim Cockshell has to say about that as we continue. And again, want to invite you to join us Saturday night, Theater at Ace Hotel, 7 o'clock, 50th anniversary screening of The Graduate on the big screen, and then on stage for conversation afterward. The film's writer, Buck Henry, will be with us. Its producer, Lawrence Terman, will join me. Our Film Week critic, Peter Rayner, and more. Tickets, kpcc.org/in-person. Pleasure to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with our critics, Tim Cogshell, Amy Nicholson, and also joining us to talk about the future of the Star Wars universe, David Sims of The Atlantic, who's recently written a piece with Solo, as Star Wars fatigue set in. And Scott Mendelson of Forbes has written Star Wars fatigue not to blame for Solo box office disaster. The Solo we're talking about, last week's release of Solo, a Star Wars story. Let's talk with, actually, Tim, you were going to respond on the timing issue.
I have a thought, too, about you know, there are other Star Wars universes, animation. The Clone Wars series, books, standalone books, which all do very, very well. I mean, you know, I'm really deeply into that Clone Wars series. So if it is fatigue, how does one account for the success of all of these little tributaries of Star Wars?
But I wonder if the material you're talking about there, you can super serve a smaller niche audience, and that'll work. With these Star Wars films, it's a mass audience. I mean, when you're talking about, I mean, for a typical film, $103 million mm-hmm. is a huge domestic opening. But you're talking about having to get a lot of butts in the seats mm-hmm. to make these successful.
And you can cue the animation up on, you know, whatever. But there it is.
All right. Let's talk with Jason in Mar Vista. Jason, thank you for joining us on our live Friday Film Week.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, I actually agree with a lot of the points that the critics are making, especially Amy Nicholson. I don't feel necessarily that the stories are, it's not just that they're inconsequential. I think on top of that, they are almost working back on themselves, saying, oh, it's happened before, so we have to do it again, with lines of dialogue, with actions, you know, with the order that somebody shoots. And suddenly now all of these character arcs and these three-dimensional people become, you know, points on like a mind map.
I think that's so true.
That's very well said, Jason.
So many Death Stars. I mean, and to David Sims's point, which I think he's correct, and it terrifies me that the death of Solo, or the dinging of Solo, will hurt the Star Wars franchise's energy for taking risks and for being original. I think that is true, and I think it's honestly the problem here, because Kathleen Kennedy tried to take a risk by hiring Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who do great work, like revamping franchises with 21 Jump Street, with Cut with a Chance of Meatballs. She hired them to go nuts to make this interesting. Then she didn't let them go nuts, and she replaced them with Ron Howard. And I think when you play it safe like that, audiences get the sense that they're just looking for low-hanging fruit, a lazy cash grab, and I'm not that interested. And I also kind of want to say, though, to sound like a hypocrite and double back for a second, I think it's also insane that they're going to greenlight a Boba Fett prequel before we even do Princess Leia. So I guess I do want one prequel, but I think they're choosing just the bizarrest ones.
Michael in Van Nuys, good to have you with us on Film Week.
Thank you. My complaint is that, and I've seen every Star Wars movie, and I've yet to see Solo, but I will, is the fact that they basically are telling the exact same story every movie.
Oh, yeah.
How many Death Stars can we kill? How many the upstart rebels that are running from the Empire? It's literally the same story every movie. And I think where they're being hurt is there's a real dearth of creativity in terms of something that I want to watch, a story that has anything other than let's chase the new Death Star.
All right, Michael, appreciate that. Matt in Valley Village, you're on Film Week.
Hey, I think part of this is a little bit of blockbuster fatigue in that, you know, the average person, the average American only goes to movies, what, maybe six times a year. And in the last 6 months, where we got a Star Wars movie, it was kind of essential viewing. We then got Black Panther. We then got Avengers Infinity War, which are things, you know, these events that people had to go see. And maybe even Deadpool 2 counts there. And so when you get to a movie like Solo, where the reaction initially is like, I think people are saving their event kind of tickets, so to speak.
That's a really interesting point, Matt. David Sims, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's unfortunately accurate. And I think that every studio now is trying to play the game of, well, can we be this month's event? You know, can we be the big May movie that everyone has to see? And rather than trying to calibrate their movies to, you know, be a little more diverse or interesting in terms of the stories they're telling, everything is just trying to be as big as possible. And a movie like Solo is, at its heart, a caper. It's a smaller story. It's about a bunch of guys trying to pull off a little heist. And it's being dressed in this very expensive, very blockbuster, very pro forma way. And that's just going to not stand out when you're being pummeled with these kinds of movies every week.
We have Robert in Tarzana. You're on Film Week on our live Friday broadcast. Go right ahead.
My problem with, and speaking as someone who was, like some of you there, an original fan back in the 70s, is not the number of films or the frequency, but the style, which is it's just special effects and relentless action. And it's just not interesting to see that over and over and over again. Originally, when they talked about these films, they were saying, oh, in the future, the latter films were going to be more about character and dark and gray, you know, gray areas rather than black and white and melodrama, and evolve into something. And the only thing that's evolved really is CGI, you know, and that is just not interesting. So to me, that's the issue.
Robert, appreciate that thought. Scott Mendelson of Forbes, what do you think?
Well, I think on one hand, the new trilogies have been deconstructing the original black and white mythology to a certain extent. And I think that's part of why some audiences have been taken aback by, for example, The Last Jedi, which I think deconstructs the core mythology in a way that is unusual to those who don't watch the TV shows. I also think we are living in a world where every studio needs to have their six or seven IP-driven franchises in order to please the shareholders, and they're all cannibalizing each other. And the worst-case scenario is where you have a situation, what we saw with Black Panther, where you had a film that was so big, so good, and so appealing to every single plausible demographic that it literally steamrolled everything else for like the first 6 weeks or so. So even films like Tomb Raider, Pacific Rim, or Wrinkle in Time that might have been quote-unquote event films in a different era, they were borderline counter-programming.
Ready Player One? I didn't mean to interrupt, but Ready Player One would be another example, yeah.
Yes, that was sort of the one that finally broke out after Black Panther. It's comparatively died down a little bit. I mean, he still made plenty of money. So then you've got, I think part of it with Disney right now is that to the extent that they are concerned about market share, they don't mind if Star Wars takes a little bit of a hit because it's opening so soon after Avengers, or Star Wars takes a hit because it's opening so soon before The Incredibles 2, or that Star Wars takes a little bit of a hit because it's opening in May instead of December because they've got Mary Poppins Returns in December. I think they're willing to take a little bit of a hit on each specific picture.
All right.
In return for sort of total market share dominance.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. That's Scott Mendelson of Forbes, David Sims of The Atlantic, and thank our critics in studio, Amy Nicholson, Tim Cogshell. Great to have you with us, and I hope you'll join me Saturday night. Saturday, if you're listening, it's tonight. If you're listening on Friday, it's tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, The Graduate, 50th 50th anniversary screening. Buck Henry, the screenwriter, The Graduate, on stage with us. Lawrence Terman, the producer, our Peter Rayner of Film Week. Beverly Gray, author of the new book on The Graduate. All there. It's going to be a great night. Tickets at kpecc.org/in-person. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.